From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We're going to be covering the coronavirus from many angles today. In a few minutes, we'll check in the Bay Area, where that cruise ship with about 3,000 people on board is docking. But we are also watching Wall Street, the stock market spiraling down so fast this morning they had to halt trading. That drop came after oil prices plunged as much as 30% last night, the sharpest drop since the Gulf War in 1991. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She starts us off today. Jill, there is fear over the economic impacts of coronavirus, and then there's also this oil story. Explain what is happening.
Well, I just want to remind everybody, you probably didn't realize it, but through Friday's close, the oil market was already down 30%. And so there was some thought that the OPEC nations would get together and that they would agree to curtail their production to keep the price of oil high enough so each of these OPEC nations could kind of contain the damage from the coronavirus spread. Over the weekend, we found out that Saudi Arabia and Russia kind of had the talks fall apart. And then Saudi Arabia essentially opened the floodgates. They cut the price of their oil to their biggest consumer, China. And then they planned to actually open the spigots and put more oil out there. As you said, as a result, we saw oil drop down by as much as 30%. Obviously, this is a big story that is developing. It was the spur of the stock market sell-off today.
Why would Saudi Arabia want to do that? Isn't it bad for them if oil prices drop that much?
It is. And, you know, I think that we're all sort of guessing what's going on. Is this a negotiation tactic between Saudi Arabia and Russia? They're trying to get the Russians back to the table. The Saudi Arabians are the biggest exporters of oil. They could probably manage low prices better than others. But there are also some kind of conspiracy theories out there like, oh, this is their chance to kind of flush out the U.S. shale business, trying to get rid of their competition. I think it is probably closer to home in that they're really just trying to defend their own position as the dominant player in the world energy market.
Okay, and what about what is happening on Wall Street in part as a result of that, in part because of just fears continuing over the spread of coronavirus? How unusual is it for trading to be halted?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was trying to do a little history here and remember that trading halts really came into effect from 35 years ago from when the 1987 crash occurred and we had a more than 22% drop in a single day. And since then, there have been these market triggers or market circuit breakers where essentially it's a timeout. Like, hey, let's hopefully get calmer senses if we give a 15-minute break. So we've had the current rules in place since 2013. This is actually the first time we've seen these triggers go into effect from this current form. But of course, single stocks have halted trading either for news or for, you know, for some reason. But markets don't actually stop trading all that often because it is rare when we have a 7% drop in a single session.
It's funny that the response to markets that are plummeting so fast is everybody just take a 15-minute break, take a walk around the block, see if you really want to sell that stock or not. Jill, the White House is considering stimulus measures to jolt the economy. What's on the table?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different things that have been put out there, everything from a tax break to sending checks to individuals to giving relief to some hard-hit industries. And specifically, when you think about the hardest-hit industries right now in terms of real impact, we're talking obviously about the transportation industry, the leisure and hospitality industry, as well as this energy sector, which here in the United States, these shale producers are really going to be struggling. Remember, they took out a lot of debt. And if their total revenue starts to go down, if the money they make is dropping, it's going to be harder for them to service that debt. So those are some of the things that are being considered. Of course, this would actually mean that there has to be some action in D.C. across the aisle. And when I talk to experts, they're really suspect that that's going to happen, that maybe there has to be some workaround from an executive order standpoint because they don't believe that we can get Democrats and Republicans actually on the same page to agree on the right stimulus package.
That is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thank you.
Great to be with you.
Now let's check in on that cruise ship that's been held off the coast of California for days. A former passenger from the cruise died of COVID-19, and others on board have since tested positive for the virus. The Grand Princess is now set to dock sometime later today in the port of Oakland. And joining us now from Oakland is NPR's Eric Westervelt. And Eric, this really sounds like a logistical nightmare. People from different states, different countries on the ship. What's the plan for passengers after it docks?
Hi, Tanya. Yeah, it's a really big challenge. I mean, this is a port built for unloading, you know, massive cargo from China and other countries, not, you know, passengers facing a public health emergency and crisis. So, you know, federal, state, and local authorities are all involved. They've had to organize and charter, you know, planes and buses. They've installed a fence. You know, anyone on board needing urgent care will come off the ship first. U.S. citizens will be sent to, you know, one of four military bases for 14-day quarantine. There are bases in California, Texas, and Georgia. They're likely to be met by personnel wearing, you know, head-to-toe protective gear. Those, you know, from foreign countries will go on chartered flights. The State Department's helping out with those. You know, they'll be going out of a non-commercial area of Oakland Airport. But there, you know, a lot of moving parts, Tanya. The whole thing is expected to take up to 3 days. And California Governor Gavin Newsom and Oakland's mayor both underscored, look, we're going to follow strict safety measures. And they're trying to reassure the public that no one will be at risk, that all these passengers will be sent to these 14-day quarantine secure areas.
Yeah, yeah. What about crew members? I've been thinking a lot about them. What will happen to them?
Yeah, there are more than 1,000 crew. They'll be treated and self-quarantined on board the cruise ship, we're told. But it's not really clear where the ship will conduct that sort of crew quarantine. Officials say it will not be in Oakland, but where they'll go, will they just circle out at sea? Will they find another port or military base? That's still to be determined.
Okay. And there's also two other ships that we're reading about in the Miami Herald, owned by the same company, held off the coast of Florida over the weekend because of course, potential coronavirus exposure. What do you know about those warnings?
Yeah, there have been some, you know, stark warnings from federal health officials over the weekend. Dr. Anthony Fauci and the State Department, among others, issued these warnings basically saying, you know, look, if you are elderly or have any kind of underlying health problem, you should not get on a cruise ship at this time. And that message came out, you know, kind of loud and clear. And remember, I mean, there was another princess ship in Japan that was quarantined for 2 weeks last month, but that was seen as something of a public health fiasco where 700 people were infected and 6 people died. And Tanya, officials here just want to, you know, don't want to make the same mistake. They want to get passengers off the ship quickly and into better quarantine and testing conditions as fast as they can.
That's NPR's Eric Westervelt. Eric, as always, thank you.
Good to be here.
The endorsements for Joe Biden's presidential bid continue to come in. This morning, Cory Booker joined Kamala Harris in endorsing the former vice president ahead of tomorrow's primaries. Rival Bernie Sanders is now looking to Michigan to regain momentum. Joining us now is Scott Detrow, NPR's political correspondent, who's been following the Sanders campaign in the Big Tuesday states of Michigan and Missouri, where he is now at a Sanders rally. And Scott, Sanders canceled his rally in Mississippi to focus on Michigan. He's trying to capture that momentum we were talking about that he had 4 years ago. He beat Hillary Clinton back then. But this time around, it seems he's facing an uphill battle.
Absolutely. Several polls out in the last day or so show that former Vice President Joe Biden might have a big lead in Michigan. That would really hurt Sanders' campaign in terms of the political conversation. This is a state that he won in 2016 in a huge upset of Hillary Clinton. And it's also, of course, a state that was central to Donald Trump being elected president. And the Democrats have spent a year talking about their need to win back. So I'm in St. Louis right now, but that's actually the exception. Sanders has mostly been focused on Michigan, canceling events in Kansas City and Illinois, as well as the one that you mentioned in Mississippi, to spend more time in Michigan.
Yeah, in appealing to Michigan voters, Sanders has really intensified his attacks on Biden over what he calls bad trade deals. He spoke on ABC this week. Let's listen.
What I'm saying here is that people want somebody who has a history of standing up and making the tough decisions in tough times. The war in Iraq, it was not so easy.
Overall, how is Sanders' messages resonating in Michigan? You've been covering that state there for a while.
Yeah, this is something that his campaign is really focused on. Yesterday in Grand Rapids, Michigan, somebody who just endorsed Sanders, former Michigan Senator Don Riegel, made the point that he said, look, in 2016, Democrats nominated a candidate who supported free trade deals like NAFTA, who voted for the Iraq War, who, of course, referencing Hillary Clinton. These are two things Sanders has talked a lot about with Joe Biden. Their argument is that Democratic voters just are not excited about a policy like that, statements like that. You can look at what happened in 2016. But, of course, poll after poll is showing that Biden may be opening a big lead. And this rally that's going to happen tonight with Cory Booker and Kamala Harris is just the latest sign of him consolidating party support.
And, of course, Sanders has said he's been struggling to connect with younger voters. And as you said, we'll be watching what happens there in Missouri and also the run-up into Michigan. That's Scott Detrow. He's NPR's political correspondent. As always, thank you, Scott.
Sure thing.
On a secret military recording, a sound so haunting, one scientist believed it could change the world.
My mind was racing as I listened to this, and I thought, this is the way.
Join NPR's Invisibilia for the first episode of our new season.
Some of the most significant things the United States government has done to deal with climate change happened because of a Supreme Court decision. The case was Massachusetts versus EPA, and it was decided in a 5-4 ruling in 2007. It laid the groundwork for many of President Obama's climate policies. And there's a new book out this week looking at that case. It's called The Rule of Five, Making Climate History at the Supreme Court. Its author, Richard Lazarus, teaches at Harvard Law School and has represented the government and environmental groups in 40 Supreme Court cases. Richard Lazarus, welcome.
I'm delighted to be here, Jeremy.
Well, let's talk about this case, first of all. It goes back to 1999 and a man named Joe Mendelson, who delivered a petition to the Environmental Protection Agency. Who was he and what issue did he have with the EPA?
Yeah. So Joe Mendelson is what I would call one of the second generation environmental lawyers. He goes to law school. He works for an environmental public interest group no one has ever heard of. They're paycheck by paycheck at best. And he's concerned about climate change. In the beginning, he's actually optimistic. The new president of the United States is Bill Clinton. The vice president of the United States is Al Gore, who in June of 1992 wrote the book called Earth and the Balance on Climate Change, saying this was the single most important threat facing humankind. But Joe grew increasingly frustrated during the Clinton administration because they did a lot of really good stuff on environmental law. They did nothing on climate change.
And he wanted them to regulate carbon dioxide as an air pollutant under the Clean Air Act.
That's exactly right. He thought it was obvious. He thought the science was clear. All the other environmental groups, all the mainstream, we call the big groups, they all said, Joe, quiet down. Don't rock the boat. Don't give them a hard time. We'll do better next time. And Joe finally got fed up. He walked down to EPA and handed them a petition which said, I think you've got an obligation of the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases. And it was such a controversial move when he pushed that on EPA that even some of the other environmental groups managed to lobby to cut off his funding.
That's so interesting because it reminds me of when same-sex marriage was brought to the Supreme Court. There were a lot of people who wanted same-sex marriage to be legal in this country who said, no, don't do it now. This could be the wrong time. You might lose and that would be even worse.
Exactly right. It's about strategy and timing. And when the stakes are big, that's exactly when these disagreements – they're good faith disagreements. They're not bad faith. But the battles are no less intense.
Well, one of the interesting things about this book is that you learn a lot about the inner workings of the court. And of course, you have represented the government and environmental groups in 40 cases before the Supreme Court. You've presented oral arguments in 14 of them. How does the court decide which case it's going to take?
Yeah. So what the court does is the court basically gets these documents called petitions for writ of certiorari. They get about 10,000 of those a year, they grant 70 of them. Mm-hmm. When the justices look at that petitions and their law clerks, they're looking for several things. They're looking for what is an important legal issue, and they're looking for something where they think the time is right. In the past, the court has often just never seen it to be important or the time is ripe when the environmentalists have lost in the lower court. They've been pretty ready to grant cases when the government has lost or industry has lost. And that's what made this so unusual.
Well, and how much do they know about science, these justices?
Oh, they know nothing about science at all. And that's why the people who want to get the court to take the case here were very clever in how they presented it. They didn't present it really as a climate change case. because if they did, they didn't think the justice would be that interested in it. So they presented the case as a sort of a technical question of administrative law. So it was done very cleverly by the environmental lawyers here, is they pitched the case to the court and trying to get the court to take the case. They pitched it as an administrative law case and not as an environmental case.
About whether the EPA got to decide whether to regulate greenhouse gas emissions as part of the Clean Air Act?
Yeah, basically whether EPA had the discretion not to decide the issue yet. They even buried in their petition the issue they cared the most about, and that's whether greenhouse gases are in fact air pollutants or not, because they didn't think that would attract the justices. And then in sort of what is known as classic bait-and-switch strategy before the Supreme Court, once the court granted review, they then buried the issue they said was so important, and they put front and center the big question they cared about, and that's whether greenhouse gas are air pollutants or not. That's what Supreme Court lawyers do who know how to sort of manipulate the process a bit.
What was it like when you first argued an oral argument before the Supreme Court? That must have been pretty scary.
Yeah, it was actually pretty scary. I remember I argued my first case before the Supreme Court in October 1986. I was a pretty young person back then. I remember when I got asked the first question before the court is by Justice Harry Blackmun. And my first reaction was sort of to exclaim to myself, wow, that's Justice Blackmun. He's asked me a question and then proceed to answer it. But it's quite fun because when you actually argue before the court and the arguments are an hour, half hour each side, it's like a conversation. You're in this extraordinary majestic room. But you're engaging in a conversation with the justices, and they're good lawyers, and they ask real questions, and you get to talk to them about the case.
And in this case, Massachusetts versus EPA, the justice that was on everybody's mind was Justice Anthony Kennedy, who for so many cases was the swing vote.
That's right. And this case was no different. Justice Kennedy, when he was on the court, was the decisive vote in basically every single environmental case in over three decades except one. And everyone knew this case would be no exception. And Justice Kennedy was not a liberal justice. Justice Kennedy was not an environmentalist. Justice Kennedy was someone you had to figure out. And the justice who really succeeded to that here and led to the result played no less a role than anybody else was Justice John Paul Stevens. He was the senior justice of the majority, and he had to make two really important decisions here once the vote was made. One was who'd write the opinion. And the other was, since he decided he would write it, how to write it to keep Justice Kennedy.
So even after you kind of know that Justice Kennedy is going to be on your side, you've still got to write the opinion in a way that he doesn't decide to leave.
Oh, absolutely. What happens is the justices meet 2 days after the argument in a private conference. No one is allowed in the room. And they vote. And they go around the room. The senior justice goes first down to the junior justice, and they vote. In this case, they went around the room on December 1st, 2006, 2 days after the argument, and Justice Kennedy provided the fifth vote. That meant it was a tentative vote of 5-4. But votes change all the time. Mm-hmm. And Justice Kennedy was known for changing his votes in cases, including environmental cases. So when you have the initial vote, and the public doesn't know about this initial vote, it's all private. So Justice Stevens could have done one strategic move, which he told me. I talked about this case. He could have assigned the opinion to Justice Kennedy. That would have maximized the odds that Justice Kennedy would have stayed in the majority. But Justice Stevens decided to take a chance and assign the opinion to himself because he was worried if Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion, it made it more likely he'd stay. Not a sure thing, but more likely. But it would be a very narrow opinion, which wouldn't establish much law. And what Justice Stevens told me was this was a really important case to him. He could not understand why so many people, including so many Republicans, and he was a Republican, didn't understand the seriousness of climate change. He wanted to make a statement.
So what was the significance of this case in the end? People say that it laid the groundwork for President Obama's Clean Power Plan, which was hailed by environmental activists as a major step toward curbing greenhouse gas emissions. But the Trump administration quickly unraveled that.
Yeah. No, it's called the most significant environmental law decision ever by the Supreme Court for a reason. And that's because it did lay the groundwork for absolutely every single thing the Obama administration did, all the motor vehicle rules, the Clean Power Plan, the methane rules, sort of across the board. It led to Paris. You would not have had the agreement in Paris in December 2015 for the first time 189 nations coming together. You're right. Now, the challenge is, to what extent can basically all that was accomplished by Massachusetts, the promise that was realized during Obama, to what extent can it be protected? For the past 3 years plus, there's certainly been a lot of efforts by the Trump administration to unravel those. Those are all being challenged. Those have not yet succeeded. The Paris withdrawal has not yet happened. Under the procedure of the Paris Accord, it doesn't happen right away. And that's actually what makes this election coming up so important for climate issues. Because if the Trump administration is confined to 4 years, basically every single thing that happened during the Obama administration can be protected. If there's another 4 years, it'd be much harder to protect all those regulations, all those rules, and harder to protect the Paris Agreement.
Well, and also President Trump could easily get another justice or two on the court.
That's absolutely right.
Richard Lazarus, a lot of people are concerned about growing partisanship on the court. Do you, as someone who has spent so long and has such a deep relationship with the Supreme Court, not to mention your close friendship with the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, do you still have faith in the Supreme Court as an independent arbiter?
I still do right now, but it's clearly under siege. I mean, I think the court has been working very hard. Certainly the Chief Justice has been working very hard to create not just the impression but the reality that they're not just a partisan branch. But that's harder to maintain over time. If the other branches, pick the Senate, wants to turn them more partisan, they can do that. If candidates for president like Donald Trump did in 2016 campaign for office by listing the people he will put on the Supreme Court, vote for me because these are the people I will nominate, and then the Senate confirmation hearings become the kind of debacle we've seen recently, it's very hard for the court to maintain that nonpartisanship if the other two branches basically are trying to bring them in their debate. So at the moment, I think this is they're at risk.
That is Richard Lazarus, whose new book is called The Rule of Five, Making Climate History at the Supreme Court. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
More than 30 states and the District of Columbia are now reporting confirmed cases of the coronavirus, and several have declared emergencies, including Washington State. There have been at least 19 deaths there, and the state has the highest number of confirmed cases in the country. There is also a presidential primary taking place in Washington State tomorrow. The good news is the state uses mail-in ballots. Amy Radel of member station KUOW reports.
With recent polls showing Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden neck and neck to win the Democratic primary in Washington State, Sanders field director Sean Scott says their campaign continued door-to-door canvassing this past weekend despite the growing coronavirus outbreak here.
Well, there's never good timing for a global health pandemic. And with us, you know, we certainly had our concerns about what that was going to do to our goal of knocking on 60,000 doors. All
right. About 50 mostly young Sanders supporters gathered yesterday morning on Lake Union in Seattle to head out to canvass and knock on doors. Preschool teacher Leia Dale says she's paying attention to the public health advisories, but so far people have been welcoming when she knocks.
I haven't shown any symptoms. If I had shown symptoms, then I definitely would stay home. I wouldn't be out canvassing, but I just think it's really important that we hit the last doors before Tuesday, so...
The Sanders campaign has continued full speed ahead, even with plans for a primary night gathering on Tuesday to hear initial vote tallies announced. The Biden campaign says, given experts' recommendations, it is not doing any in-person canvassing or events, including on primary night. Public health experts are advising people to work remotely if possible and avoid large gatherings. Kendall Hodson is chief of staff for elections in King County, the county with the most coronavirus cases so far. She says they are very grateful that Washington is a vote-by-mail state. It has no polling places where the virus could be spread.
By and large, that's one of the biggest things we have going for us. Of course, we also can't work remotely. Ballot processing is a very physical in-person activity, so we've got all of our teams still here, but we are taking a number of precautions.
like hand washing and mandatory latex gloves for the county's 150 temporary elections workers who help process the ballots.
You don't know what's going to come out of these ballots.
That's Jan Reese. She's been helping with elections for the past 12 years.
We use sanitizing all the time. We go to break. We wash our hands and, you know, sing a little ABC song while we're doing it so we get the vaccine.
It's the type of public health advice that is everywhere these days. Hodson says there was a fear that people could spread the virus by licking their ballot envelopes, but public health said that's not a concern.
They are not recommending against that, so it's perfectly fine, and that our staff here should feel comfortable and safe handling ballots, but should be wearing gloves.
Mostly out of an abundance of caution. The main concern is people spreading the virus by being close to one another. Hodson says so far they haven't seen more people calling in sick. And she says people are trained in various duties so they can fill in for one another if needed. Hodson says if all goes as planned, the initial tally in Washington's presidential primary will be announced tomorrow just after 8 p.m. Pacific time. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Radel in Seattle.
And since Amy filed that story, the Sanders campaign has announced it is canceling its gathering planned for tomorrow night.
Every year since 1978, there's been a citywide search in New York for the highest achieving students of color. And these kids go on to take accelerated classes and enroll in the city's most elite private schools as part of a program called Prep for Prep. There are similar programs in cities and towns throughout the country. And our next guest wonders if these programs, while offering opportunities to some, obscure deeper educational inequalities. Vincent Cunningham is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He recently wrote about this, as well as his own experience in the Prep for Prep program. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So, Vincent, you start off your essay by taking us back to Brown versus Board of Education and the tried experiments in New York City to desegregate public schools. And I was struck by the use of the word experiment in the form of Prep for Prep, or really any gifted or talented accelerated program. Can you explain your thoughts on this?
Sure. And it's not just gifted and talented education. Educating children of color has been an experiment sort of from the beginning in our country. You know, I didn't put this in the piece, but my mom was bused to schools, for example, another experiment that happened in the late 60s and 70s. So there's always been this issue of working around essentially racial backlash of against school education after Brown versus Board. Schools, in fact, got more segregated based on the backlash of individual and collective white parents and school boards really around the country, and especially in New York City. So there has been this sort of jerry-rigging that has had to happen in order to get children educated.
You've been wanting to write this story about your experience in being part of Prep for Prep for a really long time. Why?
Well, it's something that has made me who I am, and I think Prep for Prep certainly opened up all kinds of new vistas for me, new education opportunities that I didn't know existed when I was younger. As I mentioned in the piece, my wife is a alum of the program. Many of my best friends are. So it's something that I've always thought in the back of my mind might be something to write about.
Yes, you definitely write in a complex and nuanced way your experience from being in the program and then post-program. You write, quote, "Much of what I have that is good I can trace back to the program. The change isn't only personal. No matter the context, certain privileges accompany being thought smart. Teachers kindle your ego. People listen when you talk." Can you explain more about that?
I think this applies to everything. This isn't just Black children or Latino children. This is everybody. Whenever you enter a new context, there's this strange doubling that happens. On your end, you're seeing something new. You've expanded your view on existence has opened up, even if it's just a crack. But at the same time, you become a new element in that place. So you start to be seen in different ways. And often you don't notice that until much later, that, you know, your presence, for example, if you're a Black kid in a largely white school, like I was in high school, that you mean something to those people around you in a way that, you know, you might not even notice.
Hmm. You write, "Alongside my friends, from a jarring double vantage of privilege and its lack, I came to know America better and began honing my responses to it."
It's interesting. Whenever you're in a place that's not necessarily consonant with where you're from. You feel that tension. There's a sort of rub of one experience against the other. You know, most of my friends in high school, we weren't from wealthy families. Our families were mostly, you know, working class, but we were at the school with people who certainly were not that, you know. And the piece I write about a friend of mine, an older kid, was the person that I was with when we found out that the police officers who had killed Amadou Diallo in high school in New York City, had shot him.
Mistaking him as
a rapist, absolutely. And I sort of weathered that first moment of shock of that those acquittals with another kid who had been through a lot of the same things as I was and was kind of living in these two worlds. And so there is that kind of camaraderie that comes out of those experiences as well.
Journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, as you write, has pointed out that these types of programs, while they benefit kids like you, they also obscure the system's deep inequalities because they allow us to say, quote, and this is her quote, if kids really wanted an education, if they wanted to work hard, they could get it. Look at this program. So it really just allows us to sustain all of these other inequalities or feel okay about it. Your essay really brings up this real question. Is a program like Prep for Prep, not only in New York, but really throughout the country, there are programs like this. In 2020, is this the way to lessen the educational disparity in public schools that we see right now?
Right. And what I hope the piece does bring out is that this is something that has been this question, right, of taking out so-called, you know, talented, I guess I'd put that in square quotes, children and taking them out of their contexts and using that as a way to change the face of a leadership class versus a more sort of idea of common schooling that's supposed to maybe sand down the inequalities among people. That sort of tension has been alive in America since the beginning. Thomas Jefferson, before he became governor of Virginia, he wrote some legislation that would establish these schools whereby they would sort of go around the country taking up the sort of brightest young white man always who kind of couldn't pay for school but scored the highest of these varying measures. So this is a kind of model and an idea that's been operative in American life and culture for a long time. The question of what we ought to do now, I think it's just, if anything, this is intensifying. There's always been the urge, especially of, I can say from my experience, Black parents, that, hey, this system isn't working for us. And so there is an idea of self-determination that says, okay, by sort of any means necessary, whether it's vacating that system, whether it's trying to decentralize the public schools, and by one hook or crook or another, something else has to happen because we've been in this sort of holding pattern with school segregation for half of the 20th century and another 20 years in the 21st. It does seem that something on one end or the other does have to give.
You have a quote from someone referring to W.E.B. Du Bois's notion that all races are going to be saved by exceptional men. And your source says through these programs, they help, but they don't help the collectives. That's kind of what you're talking about. Basically, our success alone does not open any doors. Do you think that we should be reassessing these programs at this time? Or do you think that we should be thinking about it more holistically, that these programs continue to stay, but we're really basically tacking on other experiments as a way to lessen this systemic segregation that we continue to see in our public school systems?
I don't know which end it has to start on. It seems to me that things have to start from the ground up. I think just like what happened in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, that this has to be led by parents who have the greatest stake in their children.
And to give people an understanding of what happened there, as you said, parents came together and decided on their own, like they were going to take control of the school systems there.
Absolutely. And they were certainly, it was a broad swath of the sort of city establishment that came together to undertake these decentralized school districts. But it was crucially on the parents that were in support of it. And that was the only way that it ever could have worked. But when you talk about reassessing these programs like this, I think it's, you know, to be fair to Du Bois, toward the end of his life, he also softened on that notion of a talented 10th and said, okay, yeah, there will be people that will be better educated because of whatever talents or opportunities or privileges that they have. But their leadership can't only be a function of their success. You know, that these people also have to be moral leaders and crucially go back and fight for the common good of all people. So while he held on to that notion, you did see a substantive change in that, you know, that idea that, as you say, their success alone would in some way herald a better future for their people.
What's been the response from people to your essay?
I've heard a lot of from people that were in the program, both when I was there and before and after. And I think hopefully the upshot of what I've seen is that there are a lot of people who have been asking these questions themselves. And I usually, you know, when you write an essay like this, that's kind of poking around and going through the years and asking questions. You don't necessarily want to get up, you know, behind a podium. All you really want is to start a conversation. And to the extent that it seems to have done that, I'm very happy.
Yes. Well, it definitely has done that. Vincent Cunningham is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and we'll link his article about the Prep for Prep program at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, Vincent, for joining us.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
We are following the spread of the new coronavirus in the United States. Today, the Dow and S&P 500 both fell around 7% at the open on Wall Street, triggering a halt in trading for 15 minutes. There are a lot of concerns about economic fallout from the virus, and we're joined now by Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So as someone who follows economics, what are you thinking about today?
Today, I'm thinking about information. What we're facing today is two related problems. First, there's a health problem. The disease is spreading very quickly. People are getting sick. They're dying. And that is feeding into an economic problem. People are canceling vacations, conferences, public gatherings. And as a result, people are going to lose their jobs at hotels, museums, theaters, everywhere you have public gatherings. So people are freaking out this morning because the stock market has crashed. And obviously, that is bad in just about every conceivable way. But the thing about markets is they have information. They are information. We know what interest rates are, and we can act in that knowledge. We know what stock prices are, and we can choose to buy or sell given that knowledge. The economic problem we're facing is information dense. But one reason why that economic problem is so serious is that the health problem is information poor. We have no idea how many people in the United States have this virus. Mm-hmm. None. We are, as my colleagues at The Atlantic reported, testing about 99% fewer people every day than the White House has targeted. We are failing by a factor of 100. So this is what I'm thinking about. The market mayhem that you just described exists on a mountain of things we do not know and at this moment are not prepared to find out about this virus.
I have to say that the quote that's been stuck in my head in the last 12 hours or so is Franklin Delano Roosevelt saying, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," also in a moment of economic turmoil. When there is panic like this in the markets, what can be done to stop it?
So the 10-year Treasury yield just dropped to an all-time low of 0.5%. And that tells us three things. First, it tells us that people are scared. Second, it tells us that the market is predicting some kind of downturn, maybe even a deep recession. And third, it tells us that the market is begging for stimulus. Now, historically, the reason to avoid high deficits, and we already have high deficits today, is that you're afraid of inflation. Well, you can forget about that. Like saying you're afraid of inflation today is like saying you're afraid the U.S. is manufacturing too much hand sanitizer, right? This is not a problem at all. We need stimulus. We need money for families. We need money for the people that are going to be laid off, for the people that are going to be in quarantine and self-quarantine. We need money now. Interest rates are telling us the government has the ability to give us money now. That is the necessary next move from this administration.
Okay, but if there is stimulus, we are now in a situation where you have the president and the Senate of one party, the Republican Party. The House is controlled by the Democrats. By the way, they just impeached him a month ago, or a little bit more than a month ago now. What kind of stimulus could happen right now? It's not going to be a package of tax cuts with Democrats in charge of the House.
I think, though, you could potentially see a package of tax cuts. I do think that in a moment like this, when the economy is just potentially going to fall off a cliff in the near term, and certainly stocks have fallen off a cliff, that you could potentially have bipartisan consensus about what needs to be done. And I think what needs to be done is to pass a tax cut that gets money into people's wallets as soon as possible. So you can do that through Social Security. You can adjust adjust withholding. You can adjust the employer side of Social Security just to make sure that people are going to get more money in their biweekly paychecks. You can start giving money out to state governments, anticipating that the taxes that they're going to be collecting are going to be hit by this recession, and they can continue to pay for health care, for fire departments, for education, everything that we rely on state governments to fund. So in many ways, I think you could see a tax cut today that looks somewhat similar to the tax cut in February 2009. You give some money directed to families and some money directed to states.
Derek, what about when it comes to individual workplaces? I was speaking with a friend who works for a major bank, and they are splitting the staff into three groups. One group will work in New Jersey, one group will work in Connecticut, one group will stay in Manhattan because they don't want everybody in the same place. All businesses are having to figure out what they're going to do right now about this and quarantining people when necessary.
Yeah, I think that when you study what some of these large companies are doing, and small companies like my own, The Atlantic, it sort of falls into two broad buckets. One bucket is social distancing. It's what you said, making sure that you keep your workforce separate, maybe asking them to stay home. You're going to see a huge explosion in remote work in the next 6 months, which in some ways might be pulling forward the future. A lot of people predicted that remote work was our future. Well, right now, it's our present. So on the one hand, you have that social distancing. I think you're also going to see new steps taken to clean offices. A word that I'm hearing across a lot of different corporations is deep cleans, sending in people to scrub down the desks, scrub down the doors, scrub down the handles, parts of the bathroom to make sure that when people come in to the office, if they do come into the office, they are coming into an extremely antiseptic environment where they're not likely to catch this virus the moment they put their hand on the door.
I did see somebody cleaning the elevator buttons today. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I'm here at NPR in Washington today, and I've been saying hi to so many people. No shaking of hands, no hugs right now, because people are worried about it, as they should be. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here It Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here It Now. Jazz fans are remembering the Philadelphia-born pianist McCoy Tyner, who died last week. Tyner was linked to saxophone player John Coltrane, who also grew up in Philly. And right now, some important sites in the city's jazz history are in danger of disappearing. That's next time on Here and Now.